Before I got to get started, what you guys are here for. So I can't ask all of you. So I'm gonna ask you the most common one I hear. A lot of people say, "I'm just here for you, Mark. I don't care what you're talking about." How many of you? Fuck. Fuck. Okay, that's bad. Because I don't work for Microsoft. I only get to come here because you guys give me good evaluations. But I think it's easier if you give me good evaluations about things you care about. So does anyone have an actual reason to be here? Yes. Real quick, guys, what?
I want to hear about this.
You want to hear about these modern apps? You are the man. Thank you, sir. You are the man. I'll tell you the talk I wanted to do. The talk I wanted to do is what's new in Windows 10? They said, "You don't know anything about it." I said, "I've been in your talks. You guys don't either." So, you started that timer 2 minutes early. I get 2 minutes. All right. Well, I think everybody's here. Is anyone not here? That's what I thought. Okay. So this is, you know what this is all about? Is that I'm a sad, sad person in the sense that I love operating systems. They're so much fun because they're so complicated. There's no right way to do them. There's been so many fascinating ones out there. And I mean that. I mean, I don't just do Microsoft stuff. At one time, I had the world's best-selling book on something called OS 2. And if you've never heard of that, it probably means that you bathe on a regular basis or something like that. It was a niche thing. The point is, but now we have a new one. And I love talking about internals. I've always been a kind of guy that I'm not a super great programmer, but I understand how operating systems work, and I'll figure out how to write myself enough Pascal or C or BASIC or something like that to explore operating systems. So I got a new one. I got a new toy last year, the year before, Windows 8. And Windows 8, in some senses, is Windows 7 Plus. Windows 7, I know that. I understand that. But Windows 8 gave us this new metro, you know, modern app kind of stuff. And so what I did was, and by the way, when I talk about internals, I've been doing it for a very long time. About 17 years ago, this other guy entered the field, Rakanovich or something like that, and he's way smarter than I am, so I don't get to do these much. But as I explained to him the other day, I said, now that you're doing that Azure stuff, you're slacking off on us Windows guys. So I'm picking up the weight. So that's kind of the story here. So let me ask, how many of you are extensively deploying modern apps on Windows 8? 8.1. Modern apps don't go on Windows 7. How many of you are extensively deploying Windows 8.1? That's what I thought. Okay, so I don't expect anybody to do this, by the way. I'm here because I imagine you are curious. The point is, 99% of the stuff that's written about this is for developers. We love them because we need applications, but not a lot is written for IT pros. I am lucky because A, I have no life, and B, I've been doing this for a long time, and so I can read developer ease, kind of. And that lets me do some experiments, and so I can explain it in terms that I think the focus here is I'm not going to teach you how to build modern apps. I'll show you an easy way, but still. I'm going to hear say, from our perspective, from an IT pro perspective, what should we know? Why is it good? Why is it better in some ways? What's its whole point? How do we deploy it? How do we at least troubleshoot it? So I want you to understand them better. Now, some of the stuff, I've only got 75 minutes. I'm going to do a flyover. For others, I'll do a deep dive. So we'll do a little of both, okay? And by the way, if I don't get to something, or if I don't have time to talk about something in detail, You guys, if you don't already have my email and my Twitter, it's at the last slide. And so, you know, you can contact me, ask me stuff about this. So again, this is all IT pro-centric. That's the plan. But first, I want to know why in this conference no one has asked, and worse, no one has answered, the single most important question of the show. And what is the single most important show? It is, why Windows 10? What happened to Windows 9? Is it chained in the basement somewhere? Did they send it to South America? Not that there's anything wrong. I've been to South America. It's a nice place, but you know. Now, I'm not 100% certain, but I have formulated several theories. May I share them with you? It's a little off topic. Is that okay? I got to check, because otherwise I'll get in trouble. All right. Reason number one. It really is Windows 9, but they used Base 9. Now, if you don't know what that joke is all about, then they didn't make you sit through number theory in third grade. Okay, so I think the big problem of Germany is a big market. Windows 9! It would be bad. Where are my Germans? Am I right? Yeah! Okay, good. Now, at this point, somebody's saying, he doesn't know the real answer. No, the real answer, it's a Java answer. There's always like people that believe this. Some programmer who claimed to be from Microsoft did a blog where he said that the setup files in Java are afraid that Java had some problem with Windows 95 and Windows 98. Why anyone would have a problem with Windows 95 or Windows 98 is beyond me, but still. And so suppose there's a configuration file that says, if the thing identifies itself as Windows 9 anything, bang, okay? That's the story. Everybody understand that? Okay. I think this is silly because in the app compat world, Microsoft does a lot of interesting things with application compatibility. And what's the very first application compatibility thing we ever did? The very first thing was we taught Windows how to lie about its age. We taught Windows how to say, I'm not Windows NT. That would be scary. No, I'm Windows 95. And it's been doing it so long that DOS did it. Anybody remember Setver? Like, hurt my head. So that's not true. And I actually checked it with Chris Jackson, app compat guy, who knows all this stuff. So you're going to see a lot of nonsense on the web about this, and I've proven that it isn't. I believe that one reason maybe is that it will distract Gartner from the fact that we have the start menu back. But if you have a lot of those big tiles, they go right off the screen. I want folders for the tiles. We've had folders hierarchy since, like, I don't know, Program Manager in Windows 3. I mean, you know. But here's the big reason. The other one, to do this one, you have to do a bad William Shatner imitation. Must break curse of the even-numbered Windows. See? All the even-numbered Windows fail. So they thought, okay, the odd numbers is when we win, we'll just renumber it. But that's not the real reason. Finally, in an insight, a flash from heaven, I got the answer. The answer is this. Windows grows not arithmetically, but geometrically. Here's what I mean. Each Windows version grows by 17%, and then it's rounded to the nearest number, you see? Vista was Windows 6, multiplied by 1.17 at 7.02, which rounds to 7. Multiply that by 1.17, it goes because that, which rounds to that. Multiply that by 1.17, and it rounds to 10. I figured this out at 6:30 in the morning, one morning. And I'll tell you why I do this. I have 3 degrees, not in computers, but like in economics and analysis. And I learned how to pull information out of numbers, whether the information was there or not, when I was a modeler. So that's my facts, Jack, okay? So what are these things called? Let's talk about what they are called. I want to talk about the platforms for applications, different APIs, application programming interfaces. I want to introduce you with those. I claim that there's not one but two kinds of modern apps, that there actually is a big divide between them. And then I want to start talking about modern app internals. And you could argue that this is a tiny bit off topic, but I don't think so. By adding a multitasking module for modern apps, in the process, they made regular old apps run better. Has anybody here played around much, just played around with putting 8.1 on older hardware? Has anybody tried that? Okay. Have you noticed the battery life is better? Like significantly better? It's because of this change, and I really want to tell you about it, because if stuff goes wrong, I want you to know that it's there. Okay? Let's talk about that. Then from there, I want to pick apart a modern app. I want to show you how we bust it apart, because the interesting thing is that the regular desktop apps that we know, well, you don't know what they look like. They could be anything. There's no rules. However, there are rules with modern apps. The nice thing about them, from our point of view, is that we can deploy them easily because they're all structured the same way, which is pretty cool. That is a good thing. It also means undeploying them becomes easy. So we'll talk about that as well, structure. To that end, we're going to need a modern app, and that's what I'm going to build one for you without a net right here, using a tool that you can get for free called Project Sienna. That will give me something called an AppX file. Entire apps are built into a file with the extension AppX, A-P-P-X. And we'll see how to deploy them and how to undeploy them. And we'll have a couple of minutes left, and I will quickly talk about how, once you have them, you can deploy not just the apps, but the tiles in a particular place, so everybody has a start screen that looks the same. Does that sound like okay? Yes? Know what you came for? Good. Okay. If not, it's the last session. I'll stick around. I can answer all. I'll answer all the questions you like. All right. So, why are they're called modern apps? Well, you may know that they were called metro apps for a while, after a particular design style. It was called the metro design style. But when they did that, Metro AG in Germany, we're back to the Germans. This is obviously a talk about Germans. And so Metro AG's big selling place in Germany. And they said to Microsoft, hey, we got trademarks on this stuff. You know, you can't just use that name. We'll sue you. And Microsoft thought the Germans had a sense of humor, which turned out not to be the case. So it's like 3 weeks before Windows 8 comes out, and somebody from Metro says, you know, we're going to sue you. Microsoft's like, really? You were serious about that? So they had changed the name, and the first new name they gave it was the Windows 8 Style Design Application. They really were called Windows 8 Style Design Applications. That name just trips off the tongue. Then they were called Windows Store Apps because you can get them from the store. Sort of like calling, I don't know, every Voyage a car app because you do it in a car or something like that. But they seem to have settled on modern apps. So modern apps, now they've been out for a while, so this is a postmodern analysis of modern apps, okay? That's the plan. In order to build applications, we need a foundation. And the foundation is called an API. What I mean is this. If you're the person writing Notepad, what does Notepad have to do? Well, Notepad has to be able to save files. Saving files is complicated. You've got to understand sectors. You've got to understand clusters. You've got to be able to see whether once you've written the data to the disk, whether it really got there or not. It's complicated stuff. You have to be able to deal with the fact that sometimes that file is right on a local hard drive and sometimes it's across the network. To make that easy for programmers, Microsoft gives us building blocks, Legos maybe. So it's easier for a programmer to sit down and get his or her job done. So, and that's called an API, an application program interface. Think of it as Legos. Think of it as a foundation. Think of it as a basis. Every operating system's got them. The particular platforms, when Windows first arrived in 1985, everybody remember Windows 1? It was a free Othello game that you could install on your machines. Anyway, the Windows API, lots and lots and lots of built-in capabilities here. If you needed to save a file in Windows, open a file, draw a circle on a screen, put a window up. These were all like cartridges on a Batman utility belt. Thousands of them. A few years later, though, Microsoft started to go from 16-bit to 32-bit. And the first version of Windows that supported at least a partially 32-bit version of the Windows API, the Win32s is what it was called, was anybody remember which operating system was the first one with 32-bit support? OS 2 doesn't count as a version of Windows. Windows for Workgroups 3.11. Windows for Workgroups 3.11 included a number of interesting things. It was Microsoft's first TCP/IP stack and also a 32-bit basis. That became larger and larger and larger. And why? Well, for example, by the time NT came around in 1993, Microsoft had realized that there are countries outside of the United States and that we needed extra, you know, originally everything was ASCII, ANSI. But in order to support other stuff, Unicode comes around. Once Unicode comes around, the APIs double. Once we go from 32-bit support to 64-bit support down the line, it doubles again, which is why we got over 500,000 items in the Batman utility belt. This making sense so far? Then, Win32 is great. You can do anything you want to do with Win32. But the problem is it may take you a long time. One example that people talk about is putting a Kinectoid on someone's desktop. Kinectoid, you may know, is that little icon that sets up remote access for you. You double-click on it, and it allows you to connect to a VPN, etc. You have to deploy these things to users' desktops, perhaps, when you're rolling out those users' desktops. Well, back in 1999, it wasn't quite so easy. And I'm told by my friends who are coders in those days that to build one was 250 lines of code. A lot of work, and not only is it a lot of work, it's hard to test that stuff. You need a lot of hardware. Remember, back in 1998, the chances were pretty decent that remote access was being done over click, ring, ring, right? And so testing that stuff wasn't so easy. And so Microsoft said, let's make life easier for programmers. Because if they make life easier for programmers, then there's going to be more apps, and that means people are going to use Windows. Actually, they learned in the OS 2 days, when you make things hard for programmers, then no one uses the operating system. And so the idea was to put an extra layer on top of Windows, an extra layer of software on top of Win32. And what was it basically? I'm grossly oversimplifying. But it's a whole pile of pre-written programs, or pieces of pre-written programs. Real, not just the basic Lego set, the Star Wars Lego set, okay? And this made it possible for programmers to go from taking like 250 lines to get a job done to 10 lines. Now, what's the good news and the bad news? The good news is it's easier for programmers to build code. So more toys for us. The bad news is that .NET is a layer that sits on top of everything else, so it burns up some of your RAM, and it takes more computing, so it slows down your system. So the trade-off is we're system's going slower, but it's easier for programmers. That makes sense. That's a bit of calculus we've been doing for a million years, because we find that hardware keeps getting cheaper and programmers keep getting more expensive. In the Unix world, they had already done something similar to this. It's Java. Java solved the same problem in the Unix world that .NET solved in the Windows world. Is this making sense? I know some of you are developers and already know this. Is this okay so far? Good, okay. Now, how do we size this? It's a different animal. It's object-oriented, which means it allows us to create objects like users or machines or memory structures or things like that. Well, it comes with classes, and classes are basically molds that you can use to pour code into to create stuff. 50,000 classes, that's a lot. It appeared around 2000, and so some of the applications you run on your Windows 7 desktops are Win32 apps, and some of them are .NET apps. Is this making sense? Here's the question. Can you tell which are which? Is Word simple Win32, or does it need .NET? You don't know, and that's the beauty of it. The difference was so small that we don't care. All we know is we install a piece of software, and the software says, I need the .NET 4.5 framework. We put it in, and everything is fine. We have to install a lot more updates, but, you know, still. And so in contrast, our third platform, WinRT, Windows RT, or Windows Runtime, well, WinRT, that was built specifically with what in mind? Well, I told you that these guys are big, 600,000 APIs, 50,000 classes. You need a big-ass computer for that, but we've had big-ass computers. Of course, what happened on January 30th, 2010, that changed everybody's mind? Steve Jobs put on his black turtleneck, walked out in front of a stage, and showed us a thing called an iPad. And nothing's been the same ever since. How many of you have an iPad? Come on, you admit it, it's okay. Right. No, they're neat, right? So they made an intelligent decision here. I remember the first time, I love my iPad. I remember the first time I went away for the weekend and I didn't bring my laptop, I just brought my iPad. I was like, oh, I make a living talking about Windows. This isn't good. Can I retire? No, not yet. So everybody at Microsoft knew that in 10 years, it's just us geeks that are going to have laptops. All of our normal friends will have tablets or just big phones. Fablets, I love that phrase. I always say fablets, anyway. So that means they need to support a platform like this. They can't have a platform that's going to be monstrous like the platform that's required for Windows. And that's why Microsoft's saying they want to be able to reshape Windows and give it the ability to kind of have a kind of sub-operating system that can run on little devices. And as you know, if you've been paying attention for the last few months, they're talking about universal apps, and that's one of the things that got me interested in this. I got a Windows phone. This is pretty cool. I think I'm the fifth person in America to get one, but so it's kind of, you know. No. The market share is getting larger. The Windows Phone market share is creeping up on other. So, but it is cool, by the way. I have written applications for the iPhone, and oh my God, that compiler was written by someone who was beaten by programmers as a child. Seriously. Objective C. It's like, in contrast, Visual Studio does a nice job. There is actually a website out there where you can drag stuff around and make a phone app. And they're now making universal apps. We're moving to a world where you'll be able to build an app that runs on your RT Surface, runs on your phone, and runs on your regular old Windows system. So this is stuff to be tracking. That's why I think it's important to know some things about this. Anyway, so this is a much smaller API. This is not hundreds of thousands. I've heard numbers on the order of about 6,000, where I said 600,000 and then 50,000. 650 was the first iteration on this thing. It tends to be touch first. Not only touch sensitive, but touch first. And some of you asked me, what are these all about? And here's my answer. Client apps. Think about what you put in a browser now. You're a meter reader, and you've got your Windows phone, and you're reading meters or something like that. For electrical utilities. I know you're going to tell me no one does meter reading in Europe because you guys have everything connected, but you know what I mean. Smaller hardware, less memory, less CPU power, but you still want to be able to do stuff that's very, what does client-centric mean? You have to be able to put pictures up. You have to be able to put user interaction devices up. But it's not going to be that powerful. You're never going to see Photoshop or IIS or a C++ compiler on modern apps. That wouldn't make much sense. Who knows? Maybe it will in 3 years. But again, go back to if you're building end-tier applications, if you're building line-of-business applications, or web-based applications. The bad part about building a web-based application is that how do you talk to your users? You talk to your users through a browser. And that is the most least common denominator, boring experience to deal with in the whole world. The notion here, which we've already seen in the iPad world. In the iPad world, we've already seen that the iPad guys, that various developers, have built iPad applications that are really nothing more than a glorified browser, and yet they give you a better experience. They're also secure. They live in a sandbox, so to speak. It'd be very hard to write malware with one of these things. Notice I said very hard. Every platform I've seen in the last 15 years claims to be sandboxed, which means it can't get out and cause troubles. Java was supposed to be sandboxed. That didn't turn out that way. So, having said that, the modern app, the WinRT box, by its very nature, is a whole lot more hobbled than Java ever was. So I think the chances of this claim happening for Microsoft is considerably higher than it was for Sun when they first came out with Java. So it'd be hard to write malware. That's the good news. The bad news is, if you want to do something administrative, that'd be hard. Anything that needs for you to be an administrator, you probably can't do. It's hard to imagine a regedit. Hard to imagine a regedit as a modern app. How could it be done? Well, you could have a service on your system. You could essentially have a regedit that's almost just HTML5 and JavaScript that then talks to a service on the desktop or something like that. But the client itself can't have that much power. But the big thing is responsive. Microsoft uses the phrase fast and fluid. How many of you have a Windows phone? Anybody have a Windows phone? Okay. I have a lot of friends at Microsoft, and they all have Windows phones. They let me play around with their phones. I was a big iPhone guy. I really liked the iPhone because it was the first phone that did that kind of stuff. But the iPhone had a tendency where it would get busy, and you'd press an icon, and it would say, yeah, I don't have time for you right now, buddy. Could you just like wait a little bit? Yeah, really? Complain to Cupertino. I'm sure they'll listen, And so, but one of the things that Windows Smartphone 7 promised was fast and fluid, and that's where the tiles first came from. These tiles that you see on Windows 8, they first appeared in the Windows Smartphone, and they were fast. It really was. You pushed the damn button, and it did the job, which was impressive. Although fast and fluid is a weird kind of phrase, isn't it? Fast and fluid. It sounds a little icky. I mean, would you date a woman who was fast and fluid, guys? Twice? Women in the room, would you date a guy who was fast and fluid? They're like, not even once. They're smarter than us. So And it's hardwired. I'm going to tell you some things you will not believe. I find this interesting. WinRT, the platform, it's like, has rules. It's got serious rules. If you're not fast enough, it shoots you in the head. I like that. It's like, you were not responsive enough to the user. You must die. So this is cool. We'll talk more about that. Whoops. Push the wrong button. There we go. To that end, types of modern applications. As I see it, there's basically two types. Many of you said you'd had an iPad, so if you haven't had a Windows tablet, let me tell you. When you're on the iPad, you see that there's a lot of applications that seem like nothing more than glorified browsers. First time I saw this, I'm getting my email on my iPad years ago, and there's a LinkedIn thing for some LinkedIn article. I push the button to go to the LinkedIn site, but the LinkedIn site says, oh, Safari, let's do something special. And so it stops me dead in my tracks. It says, I know you wanted to see our website, but no, you don't really want to. You want our app, don't you? No, I don't want your app, really. And it's like all of these guys where they have a site and they want you to use their app. It feels like it ought to say, would you like our site where A, you can't do this anymore to make it bigger and smaller, and B, you can't control as much of where you're going. So that's the first radio button. The other radio button is, and be sure to annoy me about this every time that I go to your site, you know? So, isn't that true? But seriously, some of them are good. If you use Yelp, that's a review site. Urban Spoon, that's a restaurant review site. Perhaps some of the LinkedIn stuff. Then it can be an improvement. And basically, you know what those are? They are really nothing more than glorified browsers, just specialized browsers that control your journey through the website, which might make sense. And they're pretty much all built in HTML5 and JavaScript. Now think about that. Because they're HTML5 and JavaScript, can you see how to make those universal? Of course you can. Of course you can, because everybody's got a browser and everybody can do HTML5 and JavaScript. So this is one way that a whole whack of these applications are really easy to make universal. Okay? If you go looking for them in Task Manager, though, you won't find them. They all live in a thing called www.ahost.exe. So when you see those are the glorified browsers. Notice something about those apps. They're mainly useless if there's no connectivity. That makes sense? Any questions on that?
Where's Flash?
Not on this operating system. So, the question is, Flash would be a good idea. It's just for whatever reason, Microsoft and Apple have decided they don't like Flash, and so it's it doesn't show up there. If you want Flash, get an Android. So that's the end. The other kind, what I think of as like real applications. Things that look like, for example, Angry Birds, the Kindle Reader, something like that. These work offline. They remember your state. They're typically richer. You can do more with them. Well, they're written with a whole different set of tools. A set of tools that looks a lot more familiar if you're a coder. Standard C++, maybe some C#, maybe VB.NET or VB.NET-ish kinds of stuff, as well as the HTML5. Your interfaces are often written with XAML, which is an XML tool that lets you design user interfaces. It's been a big part of the Windows operating system ever since Vista. It's one of the many things that Vista brought to us. They show up in the task list by their names. You'll see angrybirds.exe, Kindle or kindlereader.exe. So those are two kinds. Make it sense? Questions? All right, good. Let's talk about how the multitasking happens then. In the Windows world, if you have ever read maybe Mark's book, Rusinovich's book, about Windows internals, or many of the articles that are out there about how the multitasking works in Windows, this is something that Microsoft's been working on for literally decades. Windows 3 was a joke in the way that it multitasked, in the sense that when an application took center stage, it could keep the center stage until it yielded it. And that's why Windows 3 had so many problems. The Mac OS had the same problem until OS 10. It's a hard thing to build an operating system where zillions of little threads are all running, and somebody's got to juggle them, and somebody's got to keep track of who deserves the CPU at this moment in time. The one that's in Windows is extremely sophisticated. I have watched its structure as the years have gone on. Adding extra CPUs really changed things. I remember in Windows 2000, I was running PowerPoint, and it would crash all the time. I was the only guy in the world that it crashed for. I had a two-core desktop. Nobody had multiple cores, and they hadn't even tested PowerPoint on a two-core system. But that's, the story's much changed now. I mean, now Windows runs with, 256 cores. So it gets more complicated. With modern apps, though, it's a different story. Remember I said that modern apps are very client-oriented? They don't do much in the background, and their job is to respond to you. Not only that, they want to respond quickly. So the multitasking that you're going to see amongst the modern apps is pretty simple. The guy in the foreground gets all the CPU. That's going to deliver big battery savings, as I told you. So if nothing else is happening, the foreground app gets all the CPU juice. Background tasks, so if you start a task and then bring another one up, that other task isn't dead, it's just in the background. Background tasks still get some service, and I will talk to you about that in a moment. But what would a background task be? Well, if I'm a modern app that does mail, well, you certainly want, even if it's in the background, for it to know you have mail coming in. If I'm running a modern app that does Skype, I wouldn't do that. I think the desktop app's better. But, you know, if you're running the modern app version of Skype, then it should know that an incoming call is happening. If you're running a Twitter app or a Facebook app, it should be able to keep updated in the background. So there's a little bit of background that even a modern app needs. That makes sense? Because I'm going to tell you something you'll find quite surprising. If you need to run in the background, you could do that. But there are, again, very strict rules. In Metro, the trains run on time. Okay? If you're in the background, first rule, when you start up as a modern app, you got to start up in 5 seconds. From the time I take my finger and push on your tile to the time you're talking to me, better be 5 seconds or bang, they shoot you in the head. The exception is the Windows Store app, which can take all the time that it likes to start up, but I'm sure it's special for some reason, because it's the app that gives us apps. That must be it, okay? When you're put in the background, if you are the Delta Airlines app, I'm looking at you, and I decide to pull up the calendar app. Well, it's probably because I want to figure out when to book that flight. But you, as the Delta Airlines app, have 5 seconds to save the state. You don't know if I'm never going to bring you back or not. So you've got 5 seconds. That's it. And if you haven't done by then, too bad. We're pulling the plug anyway. And if you are in the background and you get resumed, you got 2 seconds to respond. Make it sense? Those are ironclad rules. Forgive me, but I find that fascinating. I really do. And it really works. If you put something in a Windows Store and it doesn't meet those criteria, it's not going to get in the store. That's kind of cool. So, more specifically, what I just told you is a little incomplete. So all the foreground data goes to the foreground app. That's correct. But what if I put you in the background? The chances are very good that I'm swapping between two apps, like, for example, a calendar app and the Delta app. In that case, you continue to get, if you're the Delta app in the background, you continue to get CPU power. You share the CPU with the foreground app for 10 seconds. So you have 10 seconds. And why? Because the chances are good that you're swapping between apps. After that 10 seconds, Delta app, it's 8, 9, 10, you're gone. Obviously, he doesn't love you. You're in the background for real. Which means you have 5 seconds to save your stuff, because if you're not done at the end of five, then that's what happens, okay? And that's interesting. It really is. Has anybody here ever written an application, a Windows app? Okay. When you're writing a Windows app, the way you shut down Word is you click that X up in the Word corner. Do you know what that does? The operating system sends a message to Word, says, listen, Word, I'm sorry, man, but the user wants you dead. And Word could say, not just now, 5 more minutes of TV? Could I just have 5? Oh, really, just 6. I got to finish this Facebook. I'll get right back to you. And you know that's true, because what happens when you do a shutdown command? Does Windows shut down? In most cases, it says, well, I was trying to shut down, but Explorer has a folder open. And Word hasn't finished counting down from 1,000, and there's just so much that's happening. So. Now, you could still shoot it in the head. You could say, shut them down anyway. But Windows says, fine. It's not my fault if your data's corrupt. You know? Whereas in contrast, Metro has a different point of view. The Metro point of view is the customer is always right. 5 seconds, get the data saved. or shooting you in the back of the head. Now, what about the background stuff? Some modern apps do need some background time. I'm going to tell you more about this later. But the reality is this. If you're a modern app, and you're in the background, you're doing things like checking for mail or checking for incoming Skype calls or something, you get tiny amounts of CPU time. You get a half to four CPU seconds every hour. That's it. And it is strictly monitored. You don't get more than that. In terms of bandwidth, you get on the order of 1/2,000th of the device's CPU. So again, you're sitting there with a Windows 8 box. Maybe you've got a tablet. Maybe it's a Windows 8 computer. And you know how when you log on, it's got that little summary of how much mail you've gotten, that sort of thing. That is all serviced in that much time. Again, I don't get out much, but I find that exciting. So, okay. What about the desktop, though? Let's talk about background in the desktop world. Background in the desktop world basically boils down to this. Do desktop apps do background stuff? Of course they do. On the off chance that you're running Outlook, you may know of that application, how does Outlook know that you've got email? The operating system isn't helping. The developer of Outlook, whoever wrote Outlook, I'd like to meet him. The developer of Outlook took the time to write a process that runs in the background. So when you start up Outlook, you're starting a whole bunch of stuff. And on a regular basis, it goes to the Exchange server and says, we got some mail now? How about now? How about now? How about now? Maybe we could do a link call. Yeah, let's do that. So even if you're not talking to Outlook, Outlook is talking. By the way, I'm not picking on Outlook. I'm just using it as an example. Because as I'm sure you know, Outlook is the single most reliable application available in the Microsoft marketplace. Okay. So, but here's the question I want to know. Okay, Outlook may be great, but I'm an operating system guy. I'm not an application guy. How much time is Outlook going to use talking to Exchange in the background? I have no idea. It boils down to whatever the developer of Outlook said. Now, as you know, you can actually fine-tune this in Outlook if you like. But the point is, does the operating system... In a metro world, in a modern app world, it would say to the operating system, pretty please, can I go look for some mail? But in a desktop world, pre-metro, Outlook just says, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to take some CPU time, I got to go check the mail. And again, and again. And lots of things do this. So it's however Outlook's author set it up. Thus it can... You know, imagine you're running Outlook on a computer that's trying to be asleep, and it could be burning up as much, you don't know how much time it could possibly be burning up. So Outlook's authors get to affect that stuff. And it's not just Outlook. There's a lot of desktop applications out there that are doing this sort of thing. Now, how did modern apps fix that? Modern apps fix that by saying, you know, we can sit down and on a single whiteboard lay out what kind of background stuff's got to happen. For example, people want to do background file transfer. In the Outlook world, the Outlook's author's got to write that. In the IE world, the author of IE has to write that. In the modern app world, you don't have the choice. There's a background routine. We hope you like it. Okay? And you will. It runs in the background. And what does that mean? The operating system can tightly control the CPU and the bandwidth. Is that making sense? There are very specific triggers. An email's coming in, a voice call's coming in, instant messages coming in. We've got, background's very restricted, and so it's hard for modern apps to hog the system because a modern app author doesn't get to write a background process. That's important, but I want to make sure you got it. Yes? Okay, good. Thank you. Let's keep going. So now we want to control how the CPU is being worked hard on. And so we want to do that in such a way as to reduce the amount of battery life. Microsoft's goal with Windows 8 was the following. Think about what you do with an iPad or your phone. So if I've got a smartphone, whatever kind it is, Android, Apple, Windows, whatever, if the screen is turned off and I put it on the table, I expect to be able to come back 4 hours later and find that very little battery has been burned down. But Twitter's up to date, my mail's up to date, I get a you missed a Skype call, etc. How do we do this? In order to do that, we've got to understand how multitasking works. So here's how it works. As soon as you press the screen off button on any Windows 8 device, Windows 8 shuts down the digitizer, the keyboard, the mouse, etc. That's good. We save a lot of power this way. Because if you turn the screen off, Windows figures you don't want to talk to it, and it doesn't take it personally. Okay? Then check for any RDP sessions. Clearly, if someone is remote desktoped into this computer, then you got to keep it awake. Next, a thing called the Process Lifetime Manager. And by the way, these slides are already on ComNet, so please don't worry about taking notes. All this stuff is here. Okay? On the Metro side, how many apps are running? On the modern app side, how many apps are running? Just one, the foreground app. We suspend that. How long does that take? How many seconds? 5 seconds. 5 seconds, exactly. So now how much power are the modern apps using? None, because everybody's dead. There's a little trickle to support the background stuff. Now let's look at the desktop apps. The desktop apps are more complicated. And why? I've already talked about that. How much does Outlook do in the background? I have no idea. How much does Word do in the background? I have no idea. How much does PowerPoint do in the background? I have no idea. How much does Flash do in the background? I don't know, but in the foreground, it always wants me to update it, so. The idea is everybody's talking to everybody else, and we don't know what the interactions are, and the fear is this. The fear is we want to shut these guys down or put them to sleep a lot. And if I decide to put, what if I put Word to sleep first, and that screws things up? So they created a whole new state for processes in Windows 8 called frozen. So it's basically like the idea is that they take all the desktop apps, that's the word for the things that are the old style apps that we all use, and you go freeze, and everybody, same time, freezes. They're asleep for 4 hours. When you wake them up, they're like, something happened. The time is different. But we lie to them. We say, oh, you were in hibernation. You don't remember? Hibernation's like that. It just, yeah. So what do we have running on the desktop side? We have the apps themselves. Okay. And how do we deal with that? We flash freeze them. And we're going to take them out. We'll tell them that they hibernated. That's good. That means the apps are going to keep working. Nothing's going to break. What about services? Those are a real bear. Those are a real bear because they're always running. Right? We've got to have those services running, and we really can't shut them down altogether. If you shut down system services, interesting stuff happens in Windows because we can't have any background processing. So what Microsoft does is a thing called the Desktop Activity Monitor Resiliency. And what it does is this. Basically, on a case-by-case basis, the Microsoft guys in the operating system have figured out what services can be slowed down without killing the operating system. Basically, they've fine-tuned this. What about third-party apps, Mark? Microsoft has a database of 1.5 million third-party apps, and they've tested it against all of them. Isn't that cool? So they figured out how far they can push the stuff that's in the market without breaking things. And the new stuff, with hope, have read the memo. Right, so. Networking's a fascinating one, too, because we don't want to shut the network down, right? If we're a mobile device, we've got a wireless device, and it's sucking up power, what are we going to do about that? Huh, well, it's interesting. So what we're going to do is that we have all of our network cards we've bought in the last 5-6 years are smart. They've got honest-to-God CPUs on them, not just little things. And think about what happens with networking, particularly wireless networking. With wireless networking, if there's 20 devices, or excuse me, if there's 200 devices, 300 devices in this room, they're all talking to each other. So if my device is just talking to your device, we're not having a private conversation. Everybody in the room is overhearing us. But what does that mean from a power point of view? If I'm talking to you, everybody hears the conversation, and so all these guys are trying to sleep, but in the Windows 7 world, their network cards say, CPU, hey, CPU, CPU, you gotta wake up, there's a message. And the CPU wakes up and says, yeah, what is it? There's a message. Well, who's it for? It's a message from me to that other person. It's a message from that guy to that guy. I don't know those guys. Why did you wake me up? Because it's not my job. I'm just a network card. So the network card wakes the CPU up every single time there's any kind of message, any kind of communication going on. What Windows 8 does is it takes this capability that's been in the hardware for the last 7 years, where we say, listen, network card, listen very closely. Remember those applications that didn't respond quickly enough, and bam, we got that for hardware too. That's a lie. Here's the rule. You stay awake, you track all the communication. Don't wake me up unless it's for me. So what happens is the CPU goes to sleep, stays asleep. The NIC is still running, but it's not bothering anybody. This is called network quiet mode. Of course, for networks, it's never quiet mode, right? Because networks run all the time. So that, then we go to I/O coalescing and resiliency. Interesting stuff, really interesting stuff. And here's the way this works. This first appeared in Windows 7, they made it better in Windows 8, and in Server 2008 R2, of course. The idea is this. Apps wake up on a regular basis. Exchange waking up to check for mail. Some other, many applications wake up on a regular basis and look at the NTFS change log to find out if anything's been written to the file. Anti-malware apps do that sort of thing. Some things just poll Explorer. So they have these timers. What happens is you can build an app, most big apps are built, where they got a chunk and they've programmed Windows with a timer. They say, wake me up every 10 milliseconds. Okay? So let's see how something like that happens. So our goal is we want to get all the applications. We got lots of timers going on, and they force the CPU to wake up. And our goal is, instead of having lots of timers, let's coalesce all the timers into one or two or some small number. That's step one. I'll show you how it works. And then step two is that we'll stretch out that time. Let's see how it works. Okay, so I'm going to get technical now. We're going to do math. I'm going to show you that there's 10 milliseconds. We'll have a 3-millisecond piece, a 1-millisecond piece, and the remainder was 10 milliseconds. We're going to take out one. We're going to take out three. How much we got left? See, that's the nice thing about being in a European audience, because Americans would have said, no one said there was calculus required in this talk. So thank you, guys. I appreciate that. So the idea is this timer wakes up. Let's say these are stupid numbers. They aren't real numbers. Let's say it takes 3 milliseconds to wake up the CPU. That's not true. Once the CPU is awake, it needs another millisecond to service program A. So it's like this. Bang! There's the fire. CPU's got to wake up. It takes 3 milliseconds for the CPU to wake up. It says, hey, what do you want me to do? A says, go check and see if it's raining outside. That only takes a millisecond, because if the CPU is wet, it knows, right? And so 1 millisecond, so we got to do whatever. So 3 milliseconds just to wake up, then do what A needs, and then CPU goes back to sleep. So if we do this, like this, it's bang, 3 milliseconds, and then 4 milliseconds, then 6 milliseconds of quiet, bang, 3 and then 1, and then 6, bang, 3 and 1 and 6, like this. In this situation, the way it happens right now, the CPU sleeps about 60% of the time. That's good. We're saving battery. The problem is there's not just one process. There's lots of processes. And so maybe we have process B that's exactly like process A, but it's out of phase. So we get this. First timer goes off, we got to do wake A. CPU goes to sleep for a millisecond, and bang, a different timer goes off. Now we got to deal with B. Goes back to sleep, and guess what? Oh, A, it's time for A to do this again. Is this making sense? Notice the green and the yellow? What's it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Very clear. Okay, good. Thank you. So, like this. And what now are we? Now we're in a situation where the CPU is only sleeping 20% of the time, and that's really bad for battery. Can we do better? Sure. We get these guys to all fire at the same time. So there's our firing sequence. How do we make it better? We say to A and B, set your timers to be the same time. So by the way, I'm really bad at PowerPoint animations. So I just want to get you guys ready. This was a lot of work, okay? So we say, all right, we don't need the second wake, and why? We coalesce the wakes, and then bang. You want to see that again? I was like, bang. Now, don't clap, because you see how it's a little jaggy like that? That's because PowerPoint understood that it's never exactly clean in the real world. It was sending a message to me that I was trying to represent things a little more cleanly. But you see the benefit here. Because we're not getting all this wasted wake times, used to be sleeping 20% of the time, now the CPU sleeps 50% of the time. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Thank you. So that That was called coalescing. That came with Windows 7. So reviewing, what we've seen so far is that we have something like this. Now let's look at what Windows 8 does. So what Windows 8 does is this. So Windows 7 did the thing you just saw. So now we get the situation. We're back to just A. I'll keep the picture simple. It's bang, do some work, bang, do some work, bang, do some work, bang, every 10 milliseconds. Remember? Here's what the desktop activity moderator resiliency does. It says, you know what? Let's just do it like this. What's happened here is that the operating system has decided that this thing is waking up too often, and it's just letting it sleep late. So it's saying, am I waking up every 10 milliseconds? It's like, yeah, it's 10 milliseconds. Yeah, you bet. Again, how'd this happen? Microsoft did a lot of work with a huge database of applications to say, how far can we stretch it? Lots more CPU sleepy time. The idea is to save further on the CPU, fires the timers less often than normal, and then lies about it. Tell me you've never been a manager. I got nothing else to say. So with our 10 millisecond timer, as I said, maybe we could do it every 60 milliseconds or something like that, and it's all driven by their huge app database. That's a big point. Does everybody get that? And think about this. They're doing this not only with the modern apps, but with the desktop apps as well. And that's why we're getting such better life with even old machines, better battery life. So it's a cool thing. Can you troubleshoot it? You absolutely can. These are important commands. I want you to know them. Power config's been around for a while. It does some extra stuff for us now. Now, Microsoft wants to do Windows 8 and Windows 10 on a platform called Connected Standby. Connected Standby, you'll see if anybody have a Surface. The Surfaces run Connected Standby. That's an example. Yeah, there's lots of other devices. My phone runs Connected Standby. Right? Unless you're running Hyper-V and then your Surface doesn't do that anymore. But if you're running Hyper-V, you don't care about battery life because hypervisor means all 16 gigs are lit up. Oh, that's right. You can't buy 16 gigs on a Surface. That's why I don't have one. So anyway, to find out, you say powerconfig/A, and it will say you're connected standby. And as the gentleman pointed out, if you're running Hyper-V at the time, do that test again. It will just show you the standard S3 and S4. It has to shift into a different mode in order to do Hyper-V. Even better, if your system's waking up, if you're getting crappy battery life, you can type powerconfig/sleepstudy. Sleep study will show you what's keeping it awake. That only works on connected standby. Slash requests works for most other things. That's an example output from a sleep study. Take a look at that. Is there anybody here who works for NVIDIA? No? Let's talk about them. Is this making sense? That's important stuff to know, I think. Let's talk now about structure. Is there any questions on the multitasking thing? Okay, good. So let's see how we get a hold of modern apps. Typically, the way you get a hold of a modern app is you get it from the store. You have to go to the Windows Store, and you buy the modern app through there. You can also build line-of-business apps, or LOB apps. You can install those either by giving them to Microsoft to put in the store, which most of us probably don't want. I mean, if I run Acme Corporation and I've got some personnel tool, I don't want to put it in the Windows Store because nobody else cares about it. And the alternative is I have to get it in there somehow. It's possible to build things by having your own in-house store. Got any system, any configuration manager types out there? Any con man experts? Okay, good. That will let you do that. It's one of the things that you get from System Center, the last couple versions of it. If you haven't played with it, or alternatively, if you can't afford System Center, go to CodePlex, and there's a thing called Company Store. That's something that Microsoft built that you can then use to distribute line-of-business apps. And let me just briefly say, Windows 10 changes some of this. I'm not clear on exactly what it does, because we've heard some of it, not all of it yet, and we obviously haven't been able to play with it yet. Okay? Windows 10's making it a bit easier. Windows 10 makes the store part a whole heck of a lot easier. When an application is delivered to you, when a modern app application is delivered to you, it is delivered in something called an AppX package. It's a folder full of stuff. It shows up as one file, and the file's extension is .appx. And by now you know that in the Windows world, something X means I'm really a zip file. And if you rename it, then that's what you see. If you rename it to the zip file, you look inside, and if you look a little closer, we see folders with names like assets, control, CSS, images, JS, JavaScript. Again, you can see a lot of this stuff is webby kinds of stuff. But it's also standard EXE files as well. Some of those XML files are important as well. The interesting thing about this is if you buy 50 different Windows apps, regular Windows desktop apps, they're all built different ways. Every modern app is built the same way. Got the same kinds of look to it. They're all digitally signed. And digitally signed on a small granularity. Every 64K chunk, every 64K chunk of a modern app has its own signature. There's in a couple of XML files. AppX manifest, that's a map to that whole set of folders. Then there's app block map.xml. I just told you that modern apps are broken down into 64K chunks, and those are digitally signed. Why are they doing that? They're doing that because every time you go to run a modern app, Windows can check all those signatures. And if your app got corrupted in some way, maybe by malware, maybe just by whatever, it knows how to fix it, and it doesn't have to download the whole 30 megabytes of it. It might just have to download 128K, something along those lines. Questions? I said it's in a sandbox. One of the sandboxy pieces of it is that one of the SIDs they run under is a new SID. Its name is All Application Packages. If you go to the folder that holds these things, you could see a reference to All Application Packages. That's the SID's name as well. Also, once the apps are installed, they live in the same folder. The folder is Program Files / Apps. If you try to open it in Explorer, though, it's not going to work. And the reason is it's got some interesting attributes. Admins can read and execute. Regular users can't even look at it. Another thing about it is if you tracked security in Vista, then you know that Vista introduced a thing called Windows Integrity Levels. Anybody ever heard of Windows Integrity Levels? Some of you? Okay, if you went to Chris Jackson's talk, then Chris talked about it. Windows Integrity Levels, for those who don't know, is a tool Microsoft put in Vista to fight rootkits. And the idea is you can essentially mark files as being more important than other files. And everything in Windows gets a level of trustedness. The operating system is system, that's the highest. Administrators are high trustedness. Regular users are medium. And then there's low and untrusted. If you're a program, if you're an application running at low or untrusted, you can read user files. User files are marked like you, medium. If I'm a piece of modern app malware that I'm assuming such a thing could happen, modern app malware, in attempting to modify a user folder, would be unable to, even if it had full control, because the user folder is marked as medium, and the modern app, as you see, is marked as low mandatory level. Just some more belt and suspenders. Now, some people don't like this whole idea. So you can block the app, and the way you do this is in-group policies. If you've ever seen AppLocker, AppLocker's always had three areas: installers, EXE files, and scripts. There's a fourth one that comes with Windows 8 called packaged apps. You can block any given Metro, any given modern app, and you can even block the store. And if you block the store, that means there's no modern apps at all. Another side point, if you've turned user account control off, and I can't imagine why you do that, but if you've turned user account control off, Metro apps will yell at you. They'll say, I can't run until UAC comes back. You can live with that, or there's a reg hack to get around it. I'm required by law to say, do not disable UAC unless you fully understand why you're doing it. Sometimes you get a modern app, and what you'll see is in the store app, it'll get a little red line. It always does this. It shows you that it's downloading. It's a progress bar, a small progress bar. Sometimes you'll see it get 30%, 40%, 50%, and then stop. And you're thinking you got a bad connection. No, that's not it. You buy another app, and it doesn't go down either. Sometimes the store gets trouble. It gets set to be pending. It's like the drain gets clogged. It happens for various reasons. The bits downloader may have a problem of some kind, or it may be that the folder it's writing into has a problem, or maybe the last time that you tried to download it, there was, I don't know, some problem and it can't overwrite the previous temporary file. So there's a number of things you do. First is there's actually the Windows Store wants to see the Windows firewall on. It's all part of the security stuff. So try turning on the Windows firewall. If that doesn't do it, there's actually a command line tool that's in Windows called WS Reset, Windows Store Reset. Run that. It tries to clean things out. That works about 20% of the time in my experience. Rest of the time, fire up your favorite browser and Bing or Google, whichever you like, app troubleshooter, Windows Store. And a fix-it comes down, a little wizard comes down, and it does a lot of, it's successful in many cases. Turning UAC back on may help. Rebooting. And if you've ever been to Johann and Michael's talks, then you'll know about the CBS log. The CBS log also has information that has to do with deployment. Okay? Questions on that? Anybody? Anybody had a clogged store ever? Yeah. How did you get it unclogged? One of these guys? Yeah, cool. Now, we need our own modern app if we're going to be able to get some of this stuff done. And so, because the thing is, I want to show you how to do that. I want to show you how to deploy a modern app. But the thing is, you need a modern app. And once you, like if you were to buy Angry Birds, Angry Birds gets dropped on your system. And it gets dropped on your system in such a way that you can't take it off and put it on somebody else's system. It needs to be delivered to you as an AppX file. And so we need to get a hold of one. But no matter how many modern apps you own, you don't have an AppX file. You only get the AppX file if you have purchased the application from some developer or you built one yourself. The way we're going to do it is with something called Project Sienna. It's a modern app that creates modern apps. That shouldn't be legal, should it? No. So, and once you've built a Project Sienna, you'll get a deployment folder, and the deployment folder looks like this. So a lot of this, so there we get an AppX. So Sienna is going to give us an AppX file. We even get a little PowerShell script that will deploy it for us if we're the kind of people that runs other people's scripts. We're not going to be like that, though. We're going to be a person that writes our own PowerShell, or actually runs our own PowerShell commands. To that end, let's run Project Sienna. So I have it up and running here already, I hope. Yes. And it's a modern app. I downloaded it, got it through the store. And so we start out, and by the way, if you get this, there's about 13 videos that will show you how to build certain kinds of apps. You can build some kind of neat stuff with it. So you can go, I mean, it's not the whole story, it's not Visual Studio, but for the kinds of things that you can do with modern apps, it's a nice start. So to that end, we have to start off with a background. Now, this is going to be a very, 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 very simple modern app, okay, because we don't have time for anything else. So what I want is I want a modern app that's going to catch people's attention and inspire them. Inspire them to do something great or maybe something smart. And to that end, we need a good background. So I could do that just by clicking background image over here and then add image. And I got some images here. Now, originally I wanted to use this one because I took this a couple Septembers ago. What do you think? Is that inspiring?
Oh,
it's gorgeous. But you know, it's not as inspiring as something I saw a month and a half ago. A month and a half ago, I was in St. Louis in a hotel, and I was able to take this picture, which I think is more useful. This sign was in my hotel bathroom in St. Louis. Now, I think this is a piece of information that everyone should understand. I'm not kidding. This was really here. I took it down to the front desk and I said, do you normally, you do know I have a 3-digit IQ? Not a lot 3 digits, but you know. And you know what the problem was? I took this with me to protect myself later. But I'm staying over in the big red tower across the street. And when you turn it to the left, it sprays all over the floor. You have to do the right there. So there has to be some you know, localization, some national localization. But this is just a beta. It's just a beta, okay? This is a technical preview of the end. And so, you know, it'll sense your location in the next version. Right? So it's pretty good. I'm liking this. You feel inspired? I'm feeling inspired. So I'm going to say that we should, let's save it. Notice that with modern apps, we have a very simple kind of menu structure. So we'll save it. It's going to go into a folder. And it wants to call it document.cn down there, but I don't want to call it that. I'm going to call it inspiring. Inspiring. I say save. It says save in progress. You get that little, see that little announcement up there? Windows 8 loves those things. Do you know what they're called? They're like the new version of the balloon. Anybody know what they're called? They're called toast. This is called a slice of toast because it pops up like out of your toaster. I'm not kidding. See, now you know a word. So we like that. I think we're ready. I think we are ready to publish this. So let's publish. And now when we publish it, first we got to pick an icon over here. Now this is a pretty inspiring icon. Lightning bolts. They're very exciting. And but I'd like a better one. First of all, this also needs a name. Notice that it wants the name Sienna App. That is boring. I'm going to say, let's go with inspiring. What do you think? Inspiring? Yes. Let's get a better icon. I took some pictures. Now, that's an inspiring icon. But I took some pictures, and I made some pictures of me doing this so you'd want to push. That was the idea. I know. You want to click already, don't you? Right? Yeah. So it gives me other stuff. It gives me a splash screen. Now I'm going to say publish this bad boy. And it says, where should I put it? I'm going to choose this here folder. That's the one, Sienna Apps. Publishing inspiring. And look, we get the toast has popped. But the problem is the toast is purple. I like it kind of tan, you know, brown. Not black, you know. So, but purple, that would frighten me. So, after the jelly goes on, different story. All right, so we're about done with Project Sienna at this point. Now we just end up with some stuff that we can look at. And so I'm going to go to my Project Sienna folder. Oh, Sienna Project. Sienna files. There we are, Sienna Apps. And what do I get? I get the published package. I have the actual app. This is the one I could sell to people if they really wanted it. And in the published package, I see something called installapp.exe. Okay? So I say install app, and it's kind of nice because it'll do two things for me. One is it'll just do a simple installation, a one-off installation. I can mail this folder to my friend. My friend can install this, and he or she's got it on their system. Alternatively, it'll make an appx file for me, and that's the one we're going to use for deployment. But let's just try this out. Let's just do a simple install. It thinks about it. Notice it's looking for a developer's license. I'll tell you how to get that in a minute. Say done. Now, where is it? Well, if I go over to my modern apps, over there, see? It's me telling you to click. I can't resist. Must click. See the splash screen? And we're smarter already. But you know, that was all right, but it wasn't great. And I want to get rid of that thing. Yeah, I think that's the best way to go. Let's get rid of that thing. How do we get rid of it? Well, we could right-click the icon if you're that kind of person. But really, wouldn't you much rather do it with PowerShell? Let me try that again. Really, wouldn't you much rather do that with PowerShell?
Yes.
Well, for those of you who don't know, how many of you don't know Power or are planning not to learn PowerShell? I just want to see who won't be here next year. That's all. You may know that in PowerShell we have nouns and verbs. The noun we're looking for is appx package. The verb to see things, this is a safe one, is get, so I say get dash appx package. Can you guys see that in the cheap seats? Okay, I'll make it bigger if you want. If I just do get dash appx package, typically that gets me all of the appx packages. Let's see what we got. Apparently I have lots of modern apps. Let me scroll past that other one. Okay. So if we look, the last one that came up is called Inspiring. And what have we got? It's got a name, a publisher. Then there's a package full name. This is important because it's a big, ugly thing. And you need that for any of the PowerShell. Like, if I want to uninstall this, I need to know that name. But I'm lazy. And that's why I bought a computer in the first place, because I'm lazy. I could do that same get-apex package command, and I'd feed it some wildcards. So if I said INSP star, oh, look, it only gets me one. That's good. So I can do that same command, and I can use the pipeline. Now, the verb in PowerShell to see things is get. The verb to destroy, crush, kill is remove. Okay? And I'm checking twice, because if I said get-apex package and piped that, get-apex package, like all of them, pipe that into remove-apex package, that would be the beginning of a bad day at the office for an IT pro. Okay? So. And it's gone. What's that you say? You don't believe me? All right, then. I'll show you. Note there's nothing up my sleeve. Well, my sleeve is up my sleeve, but still. And all the way over here, it's not there. It's gone. But what's that you say? You want to do a massive deployment? I hear you. We go back and we run that install app again. Now we say create an appx file for sharing. It says, where shall I put it? I'm going to say, why don't we put it over in that Sienna folder, because we liked that a lot in this PC. Sienna apps. Notice also the certificate thing. Can you see that? These things are signed. By default, this thing builds a self-signing certificate. But if you want, notice the self-signing certificate runs for 6 months. But if you want, how many of you have a PKI in your organization? So maybe you got code signing certificates. This is where you would build a certificate, and you'd install it right there. I'm going to go with what we got, and I'm going to say next. It's going to think about it for a minute. It says success. Success inspiring.appx has been created. And what we got there was a deployment package. So if we open this up, that looks very much like the deployment package I showed you before. But who's the star of the show? What's the file we really want to make use of? There's our appx right there. That's the only one we need. That's the only one we really need. And I want to know its name and address, and so I'm going to shift right, click on it, copy as path. And now I want to show you how difficult it is to do deployment of modern apps with PowerShell. Add-appx package, and I'm going to right click, paste. Wish I had Windows 10, because Windows 10's got that cool, you know, that how many of you saw the keynote with Joe Belfiore? Joe didn't tell you the coolest part. He grabbed a piece out of Word, and he didn't have quotes. He had the funny quotes. Throw those puppies into PowerShell, and you'll be debugging for 8 hours. It happened to a friend of mine. And the new command prompt cleans up those funny quotes into real quotes automatically. Yeah, he would have gotten a standing ovation if he told us that. And that's it. Even better, because these apps are all neutered, they can't do dangerous things, users can install them with no muss, no fuss, no greasy aftertaste. I know, you don't believe me. And there it is, it's back. It's back. All right, with the remaining time, I want to go over some concepts that you need to know. This will go pretty quickly, but I need you to understand sideloading. Sideloading is, that's the word for, I have an appx package and I want to install it. Remember the rules in Windows are where you're supposed to get your apps from? The store. But if you built your own, you've got to do that. There's several steps on this. The first way to do it is maybe you want your users to use something in the store. Okay, great. How do you deploy that? The way you deploy that is that there's a thing called a deep URL. When you go to an app, if you right-click it, you'll get this very long URL. And you can deploy that to them. They'll end up in the store. And then once you've dealt with the credit card thing, then it gets deployed. Okay? You can also pre-provision an app into an image. I already talked about the store versus the line of business apps. Here's how sideloading works. There's several steps. First of all, you need the appx. I'll talk about how you get all these in a minute. Then you need the certs. Got to think about that. You have to enable sideloading. There's a registry entry that enables it. Then you need a license. You need Microsoft's approval for this. You may need a developer license as well. And then you install it using add-apex package. So first thing, where do you get the apex package from? You either build it yourself, or what some companies I know have done is they've gone right to the developer and said, hey, we're going to buy 50,000 copies of this. Let us just write you a check, and you lend us the apex package, and we promise not to do more than 50,000. Now, Windows 10 is going to change it. Windows 10 is going to make it a lot easier for someone to do that for you and get the software metering and all that sort of stuff. But it still works okay with 8.1. So everybody got that? It's important. The only way you get apex package, you build it yourself or you go to the developer. You have to trust the certificate. Remember, there's a certificate in there. If it's one of your certificates, you already trust it. If you've got a PKI and you're using that. Failing that, what must you do? You have to trust that self-signed certificate. How do you do that? You can double-click on the thing and work your way through some MMC, but I wouldn't do that because I have PowerShell. And PowerShell's got a really easy commandlet. Import dash certificate, wherever the certificate is, dash cert store location, local machine root. As easy as that. A whole heck of a lot easier and less error-prone than double-clicking on the little sucker. So we've got the apex, we've trusted the certificate. Any questions on this? Anybody? Good. By the way, at this point, you need a Microsoft developer's license to build Metro apps. You say, wait a minute, I don't want that. They're about $100 a year. I don't have one, and the reason is, anytime you want to build one, you can get a temporary one. Runs for 30 days. As a matter of fact, you didn't see this, but when I did the publish, it would have stopped and said, where's your developer license? I would have punched in my Microsoft account, my Hotmail account, and it would have given me a 30-day one. If you want to do it from PowerShell, you just say show-Windows developer license registration. A GUI will pop up, get your information, and get your temporary one. Or you can go to the store, and I think it's $100, $140, something like that. It's not a lot of money to if you're actually going to be building these things. Make sense? We have to enable sideloading. This is just a registry entry. You are flipping a bit in the registry. I'm not going to read it to you. You guys are going to pull the PowerPoints down, and you'll have this. If you want to do it en masse, they've even created a group policy for it. If you want to do command line, one thing PowerShell's not good at is registry. So I just go with regular old reg. That'll do it too. You then need a license. Again, Microsoft wants to make sure that, I don't know what they're doing, but in any case, it will want to see your license that gives you the ability to sideload in addition to the registry entry. Now, Microsoft changed things in Windows 8.1, made it a lot easier than it was in 8. If you're a Windows 8 Pro or Windows 8 Enterprise domain joined machine, you're good to go. But what about an RT box? What about a machine that isn't joined to a domain? In that case, you have to buy a sideloading license, and Mikey, it used to cost a lot of money with Windows 8. With 8.1, Microsoft dropped the price to a flat $100 per organization. You will then get a code, and you install it either from Control Panel. The easier way is from the command line, slmgr/ipk. That is a command you will come to know because lots of licenses are coming out, and that's how you'll get to them. You then install the package. You already saw my syntax, add-apex package, and the name of the apex. Any questions on that? Last little thing I want to do, and then we'll go. Maybe you'd like to roll out a start screen where everybody's start screen looks the same. Different organizations do different ways. You could do that. What you do, first of all, is you get a machine with a start screen the way you like it, where the tiles are, how big they are, etc. You then open a command prompt, say export start layout path to a bin file. There are two ways to do it, XML and bin. You want to do bin. If you do XML, you're locking down someone's desktop to the point where they can't even move the friggin' tiles. Now, there are certain organizations where this level of control may be required, but I think for most of us, we just want to give them an initial setup. So you do the bin. When you're deploying the systems, import start layout, layout path, whatever that file is, and then mount path, and that will always be the root of the C drive. Well, maybe it won't be. If it's an image, like an image you're going to deploy, and you've got it mounted as drive D or something like that, then you're going to change that. Is everybody with me on that? Questions? So at that point, people have the ability to move things around. You're just giving them an initial setup. The last thing is this. Windows 8.1 changed the rules a little bit. With Windows 8, anything you installed got a tile on the start screen. That gets messy after a while. So Microsoft decided that you'd like to choose for yourself whether this happens or not. And so if you have deployed a zillion applications, you're not going to get a zillion tiles in the start screen. Now, if you go to all apps, you'll see them. The ones you want pinned, though, the way you can control them by doing this. You do an export start layout, and this time you do it as XML. And when you look in that massive XML file, you're going to see a tag that refers to a particular application. Like in this case, if you know Irfan View, it's a great free graphics viewer. I just look through, you say tile, app ID equals, see that long GUID? That's what you need. You're going to need that in the group policy to say, I've just deployed 500 applications. I only want 50 of them to have tiles. And you use those app IDs to do that. Is that making sense? Okay, good. So with that in mind, if I can have you one more minute with you guys. Tomorrow, you might have heard that a friend of mine and I, tall guy, are going to talk about the cloud. If you want, when we did this in Houston, they had to lock the doors 15 minutes beforehand because we totally filled it up. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen here because you Europeans are a more sober crowd, you know. You don't ban. But anyway, bring your questions because I'll be asking you questions. We'll probably have some chance for that as well. Feedback's super important. I only get to come here because you guys keep asking for me, and they look at the numbers really, really solidly. So that's the QR. Point your phones at it. Please do an evaluation. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm at help@manasseh.com. I tweet on @mmanasseh, and I've loved being here. Thank you. Remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Bye-bye.